Chapter 11. Ridicule such considerations, but gradually you'll come to see their importance. And meanwhile, do trust me when I ask you to be guided by my mother. It is always well for a stranger in an old society to err a little on the side of what you call its prejudices, but I should rather describe as its traditions. After that, she no longer tried to laugh or argue her husband out of his convictions. They were convictions, and therefore unassailable. Nor was any insincerity implied in the fact that they sometimes seemed to coincide with hers. There were occasions when he really did look at things as she did, but for reasons so different as to make the distance between them all the greater. Life, to Mr. Leaf, was like a walk through a carefully classified museum, where, in moments of doubt, one had only to look at the number and refer to one's catalog. To his wife it was like groping about in a huge dark lumber room, where the exploring ray of curiosity lit up now some shape of breathing beauty and now a mummy's grin. In the first bewilderment of her new state, these discoveries had had the effect of dropping another layer of gauze between herself and reality. She seemed farther than ever removed from the strong joys and pangs for which she felt herself made. She did not adopt her husband's views, but insensibly she began to live his life. She tried to throw a compensating ardor into the secret excursions of her spirit, and thus the old vicious distinction between romance and reality was re-established for her, and she resigned herself again to the belief that real life was neither real nor alive. The birth of her little girl swept away this delusion. At last she felt herself in contact with the actual business of living. But even this impression was not enduring. Everything but the irreducible crude fact of childbearing assumed, in the Leaf household, the same ghostly tinge of unreality. Her husband, at the time, was all that his own ideal of a husband required. He was attentive, and even suitably moved. But as he sat by her bedside, and thoughtfully proffered to her the list of people who had called to inquire, she looked first at him, and then at the child between them, and wondered at the blundering alchemy of nature. With the exception of the little girl herself, everything connected with that time had grown curiously remote and unimportant. The days that had moved so slowly as they passed seemed now to have plunged down headlong steeps of time. And as she sat in the autumn sun, with Darrow's letter in her hand, the history of Anna Leaf appeared to its heroine like some gray shadowy tale that she might have read in an old book, one night as she was falling asleep. Two brown blurs emerging from the farther end of the wood vista gradually defined themselves as her stepson and an attendant gamekeeper. They grew slowly upon the bluish background, with occasional delays and re-effacements, and she sat still, waiting till they should reach the gate at the end of the drive, where the keeper would turn off to his cottage, and Owen continue on to the house. She watched his approach with a smile. From the first days of her marriage, he had been drawn to the boy, but it was not until after Effie's birth that he had really begun to know him. The eager observation of her own child had shown her how much he had still to learn about the slight fair boy whom the holidays periodically restored to give her. Owen, even then, both physically and morally, furnished her with the oddest of commentaries on his father's mien and mind. He would never, the family sighingly recognized, be nearly as handsome as Mr. Leaf. But his rather charmingly unbalanced face, with its brooding forehead and petulant boyish smile, suggested to Anna what his father's countenance might have been, could one have pictured its neat features disordered by a rattling breeze. She even pushed the analogy farther, and descried in her stepson's mind a quaintly twisted reflection of her husband's. With his bursts of door-slamming activity, his fits of bookish indolence, his crude revolutionary dogmatizing, and his flashes of precocious irony, the boy was not unlike a boisterous embodiment of his father's theories. It was as though Fraser Leaf's ideas, accustomed to hang like marionettes on their pegs, should suddenly come down and walk. There were moments, indeed, when Owen's humors must have suggested to his progenitor the gambols of an infant Frankenstein. But to Anna they were the voice of her secret rebellions, and her tenderness to her stepson was partly based on her severity toward herself. As he had the courage as he had lacked, so she meant him to have the chances as he had missed, and every effort she made for him helped to keep her own hopes alive. Her interest in Owen led her to think more often of his mother, and sometimes she would slip away and stand alone before her predecessor's portrait. Since her arrival at Giver, the picture, a full-length by a once fashionable artist, had undergone the successive displacements of an exiled consort removed farther and farther from the throne, and Anna could not help noting that these stages coincided with the gradual decline of the artist's fame. As he had a fancy that if his credit had been in the ascendant, the first Mrs. Leaf might have continued to throne over the drawing room mantelpiece, even to the exclusion of her successor's effigy. Instead of this, her peregrinations had finally landed her in the shrouded solitude of the billiard room, an apartment which no one ever entered, but where it was understood that the light was better, or might have been if the shutters had not been always closed. Here the poor lady, elegantly dressed, and seated in the middle of a large lonely canvas, in the blank contemplation of a gilt console, had always seemed to Anna to be waiting for visitors who never came. Of course they never came, you poor thing. I wonder how long it took you to find out that they never would? Anna had more than once apostrophized her, with a derision addressed rather to herself than to the dead. But it was only after Effie's birth that it occurred to her to study more closely the face in the picture and speculate on the kind of visitors that Owen's mother might have hoped for. She certainly doesn't look as if they would have been the same kind as mine. But there's no telling, from a portrait that was so obviously done to please the family and that leaves Owen so unaccounted for. Well, they never came, the visitors. They never came. And she died of it. She died of it long before they buried her. I'm certain of that. Those are stone-dead eyes in the picture. The loneliness must have been awful, if even Owen couldn't keep her from dying of it. And to feel it, so she must have had feelings, real live ones, the kind that twitch and tug. And all she had to look at all her life was a gilt console, yes, that's it, a gilt console screwed to the wall. That's exactly and absolutely what he is. She did not mean, if she could help it, that either Effie or Owen should know that loneliness, or let her know it again. They were three now, to keep each other warm, and she embraced both children in the same passion of motherhood, as though one were not enough to shield her from her predecessor's fate. Sometimes she fancied that Owen Leaf's response was warmer than that of her own child. But then Effie was still hardly more than a baby, and Owen, from the first, had been almost old enough to understand. Certainly did understand now, in a tacit way, that yet perpetually spoke to her. This sense of his understanding was the deepest element in their feeling for each other. There were so many things between them that were never spoken of, or even indirectly alluded to, yet that, even in their occasional discussions and differences, formed the unadduced arguments making for final agreement. Musing on this, she continued to watch his approach, and her heart began to beat a little faster at the thought of what else he had to say to him. But when he reached the gate she saw him pause, and after a moment he turned aside, as if to gain a crossroad through the park. She started up and waved her sunshade, but he did not see her. No doubt he meant to go back with the gamekeeper, perhaps to the kennels, to see a retriever who had hurt his leg. Suddenly she was seized by the whim to overtake him. She threw down the parasol, thrust her letter into her bodice, and catching up her skirts began to run. She was slight and light, with a natural ease and quickness of gait, but she could not recall having run a yard since he had romped with Owen in his school days, nor did she know what impulse moved her now. She only knew that run she must, that no other motion, short of flight, would have been buoyant enough for her humor. She seemed to be keeping pace with some inward rhythm, seeking to give bodily expression to the lyric rush of her thoughts. The earth always felt elastic under her, and as he had a conscious joy in treading it, but never had it been as soft and springy as today. It seemed actually to rise and meet her as she went, so that as he had the feeling, which sometimes came to her in dreams, of skimming miraculously over short bright waves. The air, too, seemed to break in waves against her, sweeping by on its current all the slanted lights and moist sharp perfumes of the failing day. She panted to herself, colon, this is nonsense. Her blood hummed back, colon, but it's glorious. And she sped until she saw that Owen had caught sight of her, and was striding back in her direction. Then she stopped and waited, flushed and laughing, her hands clasped against the letter in her breast. No, I'm not mad, she called out. But there's something in the air today, don't you feel it? And I wanted to have a little talk with you, she added as he came up to her, smiling at him, and linking her arm in his. He smiled back, but above the smile she saw the shade of anxiety which, for the last 2 months, had kept its fixed line between his handsome eyes. Owen, don't look like that. I don't want you to, she said imperiously. He laughed. Who said that exactly like Effie? What do you want me to do? To race with you as I do Effie? But I shouldn't have a show, he protested, still with a little frown between his eyes. Where are you going, she asked. To the kennels. But there's not the least need. The vet has seen Gary, and he's all right. If there's anything you wanted to tell me, did I say there was? I just came out to meet you, I wanted to know if you'd had good sport. The shadow dropped on him again. One at all. The fact is I didn't try. John and I have just been knocking about in the woods. I wasn't in a sanguinary mood. They walked on with the same light gait, so nearly of a height, that keeping step came as naturally to them as breathing. Anna stole another look at the young face on the level with her own. You did say there was something you wanted to tell me, her stepson began after a pause. Well, there is. She slackened her pace involuntarily, and they came to a pause, and stood facing each other under the limes. Is Darrow coming? He asked. She seldom blushed, but at the question a sudden heat suffused her. She held her head high. Yes. He's coming. I've just heard. He arrives tomorrow. But that's not, she saw her blunder and tried to rectify it. Or rather, yes, in a way it is my reason for wanting to speak to you, because he's coming? Because he's not yet here. It's about him, then? He looked at her kindly, half humorously, an almost fraternal wisdom in his smile. About? No, no. I meant that I wanted to speak today, because it's our last day alone together. Oh, I see. He had slipped his hands into the pockets of his tweed shooting jacket, and lounged along at her side, his eyes bent on the moist ruts of the drive, as though the matter had lost all interest for him. Owen, he stopped again and faced her. Look here, my dear, it's no sort of use. What's no use? Anything on earth you can any of you say? She challenged him, colon, am I one of any of you? He did not yield. L, then anything on earth, that even you can say. You don't in the least know what I can say, or what I mean to. Don't I, generally? She gave him this point, but only to make another. Why yes. But this is particularly. I want to say, Owen, you've been admirable all through. He broke into a laugh in which the odd elder brotherly note was once more perceptible. Admirable, she emphasized. And so has she. Oh, and so have you to her. His voice broke down to boyishness. I've never lost sight of that for a minute. It's been altogether easier for her, though, he threw off presently. On the whole, I suppose it has. Well, she summed up. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.